Hello, and welcome to the Thinking Elixir podcast, where we cover the news of the community and learn from each other. My name is Mark Erickson.
And I'm David Bernheisel.
Today, we're being joined by Tyler Young. Welcome, Tyler.
Hey, great to be here.
All right, let's get into the news. First up, Elixir 1.17.0, the dev changelog, was updated. As we mentioned previously, this includes a new duration type and changes to the date, date time, naive date time, and time modules to support calendar-specific shifts, like an example where you could shift a date by 1 year and 2 months, something like that, which is very cool. But there were a few other things we wanted to cover, too, that we didn't touch on previously.
For example, XUnit start supervised will now populate the callers. You know, a lot of process tree internals kind of like reference callers or ancestors. Why does this matter? It probably won't matter for a lot of your tests. But if you are testing a lot of like tasks that need to start and stop within your test, then this could probably be helpful, particularly, as I understand it, Mox and Ecto. Ecto sandboxes are tracking the processes. And sometimes when you open up a new task in your test, you have to like explicitly tell things, you know, to that test. And so Ecto wouldn't automatically pick it up. You'd have to kind of like pass the process down. Same with Mox, because both of these are operating on a process tree, storing things in the process dictionary. So when you spawn a new thing, it doesn't really carry down. Anyway, so if you're testing a process, you typically have to pass those things down. And now that callers is provided by start supervised, those libraries that are already looking at that callers information can self-propagate as it goes down. If you didn't understand any of that, the TLDRs, Mox and Ecto testing is probably going to work more out of the box, even with complicated tasks spawning in your tests. There it is. We'll see how it really plays out. We'll have some links to specific sections in their documentation that talks more about this, but excited to see what 1.17 does. It seems to be a DevEx-focused release, so we'll see what else is coming up.
Speaking of other things coming up, there are a bunch of new features in MixTest. There is this new mixed test -- breakpoints flag. So you can set a breakpoint at the top of each test and then step through the entire test execution all from within your mixed test shell. That kind of like line by line debugging is something that has been possible in some cases through other tools, but this will be certainly the easiest way to get started. There's also -- repeat until failure. So if you know you have some flaky test and you're like, maybe I fixed it, you often want to like run your test suite or run some particular file, you know, maybe 100 times or something and be like, okay, if it doesn't fail in 100 times, I'm sure that it's, you know, fixed now. And so rather than having to do a little bit of like shell scripting to do that, you can do it with repeat until failure. And finally, there's this new slowest modules flag. So similar to the existing -- slowest, which will report, you know, the slowest individual tests in your test suite. This will specifically look at how long each module took. And why this matters is, let's say you've got as many test files as you have, you know, cores on your CPU. And in that case, you know, theoretically, you are like maximizing the parallel execution time. And so theoretically, your entire test suite will take only as long as one of those files. But if one of the files ends up taking, you know, a minute, then no matter how many CPU cores you throw at your test suite, a full minute is going to be like the lowest possible runtime for the test suite. So checking the slowest modules, because that's the unit of concurrency that XUnit works with, can help you find like those long poles that are slowing you down.
That's key right there. I don't think a lot of folks realize that. They might just assume that async true at the top of your test file means that all these tests inside of it can be asyncly run, but it's actually about the module can be run alongside other modules.
Yep.
Which is nice. This is going to be cool because, yeah, I think there's a lot of teams where their tendency is like, I've got a big integration test or I'm doing a bunch of like HTTP calls to my server, testing controllers or something, like, and this controller just happens to do like a ton of stuff. They just keep on tacking it into that same test module. And now all of a sudden you've got like 2,000 lines of tests in your like user controller test or whatever, right? It might behoove you to split that up in maybe logical groupings or something and take advantage of that async stuff.
Absolutely.
So I love some of those flags that are available in XUnit. A little tip, one of the things I did recently was just mix help test and just to list out all the support for those. Because I was recently debugging some tests and one of them was just really slow, but it wasn't failing. And I was like, which one is this? So rather than, you know, because I know you can do like slowest and slow like top five and like rank them by speed. It's like, I don't care. I just did -- timeout and like 300 milliseconds. And if it takes that long, just kill it and tell me which ones were killed. Mm. That was just a really handy one.
Yeah.
So love that.
Very nifty.
So it's very cool. Mixed test is getting even better. And next up, XDoc version 0.32 was released. So for the official change logs, we've got a link to check that out in the show notes. But XDoc now uses the default OS font for content. This improves load times and readability. And apparently this is the same approach that's being done by GitHub, OpenAI, and others. The alternative is that you're downloading a specific font as part of like a CSS asset bundle or something like that. And that can just take longer. So it's like, hey, we'll just use the fonts that you have available. And also, you know, it got rid of the like serifed fonts because most of us are not using serif fonts for our stuff. I think that's a pretty nice one. You can now also preview autocomplete results and allow the search bar to be focused at any moment. That was cool because like there's a shortcut for the search bar, but like if you scroll down to the bottom, like I can't see the search at the top anymore. I have to go up to the top to be able to do the search unless I remember the shortcut key binding for it. Yeah, so just more improvements there. Very nice. And just a reminder, if you've got a library or something like that, you need to explicitly update. So it'd be a mixdepths.updatex_doc to get the update in your project. And remember that you don't have to publish a new version of your library to update your docs. You can just do a mix hex.publish docs, and you can just push out regenerated docs, getting the greatest, latest goodness XDocs without having to like, oh, I'm not ready to release anything yet. So yeah, no sweat.
I was really excited about this release. And then I was amazed by the little glow in dark mode, at least on the search bar. So I took a screenshot of it and I posted it on Twitter. And on my screen, it's smaller, but when I just got that little screenshot area, like blew it up, right? Like it made it larger. Uh-huh. And then I noticed a CSS bug in there. I was like, oh no, I'm going to hunt this one down. I can't leave this one alone. It was a one line change. It's merged now, probably the next version of XDoc. But any of you CSS nerds out there will appreciate the next version of XDoc.
And that's because you super zoomed in, right?
Yeah, I super zoomed in. That was an afternoon well spent, you know, for the greater good, getting that one pixel alignment stuff. There were two borders that had different radius. There was a gap between the two borders. If you want to picture what my day looks like, it looks a lot like that. I see something that is just off a little bit. Screw my agenda, you know, like I threw it all out the window. I got to take care of this one little thing that no one cares about.
Well, I think it's that kind of behavioral tick, or OCD perhaps, is what would save the internet with the XZ.
Oh, yeah, that's backdoor. Right. Yeah. I learned later that fellow is actually, he's a core Postgres developer.
But he's not even a security researcher. He's just a developer.
He's just a developer. Yeah. Well, yep. Superhero now in our circles. All right. Hey, coming up is a Cloudflare feature. Cloudflare workers now support WebSockets. Now, for us enlightened ones listening to this podcast, this is like, oh, what's new? It is a big deal, though. It's like building experiences. This is a quote from them. Building experiences with real-time components was previously only accessible to multi-billion dollar companies. I'd like to introduce you to a not multi-billion dollar company that is leveraging real-time components in LiveView. But anyway, they have a nice big marketing splash about WebSockets and workers. What are Cloudflare workers? They are serverless and globally deployed edge workers. Globally, I think, should have an asterisk on there. I think it's actually regional. Think of it like AWS. AWS has features, right? But only in these zones or something like that. There's a fine print there. Double check that if you're really interested in it. But yeah, Cloudflare, big, huge internet company, probably got a lot of traffic going through them. Now they have support for WebSockets. We'll see what that means for us.
I imagine that'll help a lot with some of the JavaScript frameworks who have not been able to have good WebSocket support. It was really funny because Chris McCord shared some of these on X, like some of these little quotes with these little thinking emoji, like, My favorite quote was this one. So he's quoting the Cloudflare text. It says, WebSockets have revolutionized how we think about bidirectional communication on the web. Yet the challenge has always been about scaling these interactions to millions without a hitch. Cloudflare workers step in as the hero. I was just laughing because it was back in 2015, Chris McCord created the 2 million WebSocket connections test and wrote it up as a blog post, and have a link to that in the show notes.
That was 9 years ago.
Yes. Yes. It's like, now Cloudflare is the hero because they've done it now. It's like, oh yeah, almost a decade late. Yeah.
Oh, the pendulum swings. We'll all look alike in 50 years.
Yeah, it's true.
In the same vein as the DevEx improvements from Elixir 1.17, there is this experiment on adding support for creating unlogged tables in tests. This is something that people in the Ruby on Rails community a few months ago, they were very excited talking about how they had sped up their test suites by something like double in some cases, because these unlogged tables are never written to disk. It saves a lot of overhead on Postgres, and if your tests are making heavy use of Postgres, it can get you a big advantage. And there was some speculation at the time that this was being discussed that we would not see those same improvements in Ecto because of the use of the sandbox. The way that the sandbox works in Elixir tests, that everything's wrapped in a transaction, and so that transaction never gets committed to disk. So we're kind of doing something similar just by default. Michael Gabowski has gone ahead and done the work to actually implement this. There's a pull request we'll have in the show notes to the Ecto SQL library, and you can try it out on your project and see. He's got some very easy to follow instructions. Give it a try and see what sort of performance improvement you get. People in the PR have commented on the thread. They've said they've gotten anywhere from a 3 to a 10% speed up. So it's not nothing, but it's also not huge like the Rails community was seeing. But yeah, definitely give it a try and check it out.
Interesting. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if other people can back that up. And then it's a question of, is the maintenance cost of whatever the change is worth this, you know, up to 10% improvement? Yeah, so it's interesting. We'll wait and see what happens with that. And next up, there's a new Elixir-focused book that is in beta now from PragProg. It is called Engineering Elixir Applications, with a subtitle, Navigate Each Stage of Software Delivery with Confidence, by Ellie Fairholm and Josep Giralt de la Costa. I'm sure I didn't get that right, but doing my best. But we want to talk about what this book is. This is actually interesting because it's targeting a bit more of the beginner side of the table, which is really helpful to have good book content in that area. And what this is really coming back to what is the classic idea of DevOps, which is developers and operations people not being separate, not being like separate teams, but actually having a lot of the skill crossover. And just saying, hey, how do I do DevOps if I'm doing Elixir, Erlang, or just Beam applications? So from the table of contents, I just wanted to highlight a few of the different areas that it's covering. So it's talking about Terraform, which I believe it's a Python project, you know, for doing infrastructure as code approach, you know, for setting up and allocating servers and things like that. And then Docker files, doing that for Elixir, GitHub actions, dev environments using Docker Compose, production environments using Packer on AWS. And then it also goes further into things like distributed Erlang, which is clustering, continuous deployments, getting logs and metrics and more visibility out of things like that. Really great resource to have available in the community. This is a beta release. The final version is expected around September 2024. So just want to put that all on your radar in case you're looking out for a new good Elixir book.
I love the term that I think they coined, which is Beam Ops.
Yes.
Because deploying Elixir is not really the same as you would do in a traditional DevOps environment. And I think we've all been on teams where you had some DevOps people who maybe didn't fully grok Elixir. And so they were kind of doing things the way they would for a Node or Rails or whatever it is application. I was on one team where they ran the Elixir application under PM2, which is this process monitor that I think was created for Node. But the idea is like if your Node app, if you fail to catch some exception that bubbles up to the top, your Node app will just crash and it'll be down. And so PM2 is just continually like checking, like, is the application still running? Is it still running? And it's like, this is not something that is useful for Elixir. And we tried to explain to the DevOps folks, but they were not having it. I love the idea of improving the state of knowledge around that, especially for people with a DevOps bent.
Yeah. I mean, there are, for what it's worth, there are like scenarios where the whole Beam crashes for one reason or another, especially if you got a bunch of NIFs going on. But so I guess there is some value to something like that, but definitely is not like a requirement, I don't think, because of the nature of like what the Beam is able to do and like understanding its processes and junk. Yeah. This area I'm very happy to hear is getting a book because there can be a lot of confusion. Like Elixir is quite different when it comes to how to deploy it. Clustering is usually not a thing that you have to deal with differently in other stacks. So that's one thing. GitHub Actions is included in here, which is nifty. Docker files, which, you know, there's generators for that built in. So that's kind of cool. Dev environments using Docker Compose, like There's a lot that this book's going to cover. It looks like it's going to be nice.
I'm really hoping that it covers Kubernetes and when you would want to use Kubernetes with Elixir and when not, because I feel like the default is like, oh, we are a serious company and therefore we need Elixir running on Kubernetes. And it's like, well, no, you don't. Like, what do you hope to gain?
Yeah, I think it really comes down to, you know, sometimes there's companies where they dictate everything will be in Kubernetes because that's what we do. We've made a decision from on high. So there's that. It can be very helpful to use Kubernetes if you have a heterogeneous environment where you have lots of different types of services and you want a more uniform way of managing them, especially if they need to integrate with each other. So having service dependencies and things like that. Then it's like, okay, I can see that. Makes sense.
Beam ops. I'm going to remember that one.
Yep, I do like that term.
Coming up next, we got I think it's a new library for solving constraints. What does that mean? We'll have a couple of links out to the library. It's called Fixed Point. It's created by Boris Ochner. What is a constraint solver? It's a way of expressing a problem as a system of discrete variables like Booleans or integers or something like that. And there are some ways that you can use these things. For example, permissioning is one way that you can do that. You can express permissions. If this user has this, this, and this, and then yes, they can perform this action. If they don't have this permission, then they can't, right? Another example is like Sudoku. A Sudoku solver, the constraints are that it can't have duplicates of a number within a row or a column or the 3x3 square. Those are the constraints. So put those kinds of constraints into this library and what your variables are, and it'll solve it for you, which is kind of nice. Another good example is like scheduling employees. Like you got a lot of folks that are asking for time off. You got folks that have been overused, that kind of thing. So you got your constraints and your variables in there. You don't want any of them to be over 40 hours, that kind of stuff. Want to work, could work, don't want to work, that kind of stuff. Scheduling employees would be another good example of using a constraint solver like this. It is MP complete, which means that for any input of the problem, the output is either yes or no. Which is nice. So when it's yes, you can demonstrate what the path it took to come to that solution. So it's very quick to solve that. Commercial solvers can cost like hundreds of thousands of dollars for whatever reason, really kind of an aside, but this sounds a lot like machine learning. Like, you know, like,
well, it's yeah.
They use, I think they use a lot of these kinds of things, right?
There are definitely machine learning tools that like optimize a constraint solver. The NP completeness, it's easy to verify, but it's hard to produce a solution because there are like so many variables that you have to like try all the combinations. And so if you have an AI system, if it knows like the types of problems, it can kind of do some shortcuts and maybe get to a, maybe not the globally optimum solution, but a good solution fast. Yeah, totally.
Ah, nice. All right. So the library is proof of concept, which means it's still very early. Don't bet your company on it quite yet, but it is implemented based on a book called Concepts, Techniques, and Models of Computer Programming by Peter Van Roy and Seif Haridi. This is definitely one of those like hidden gems of getting your business logic to just work without brute forcing your logic to make things work and make sense and be bug free for the most part. If that's of interest to you, it's called Fixed Point. We got links to it in the show notes.
And last up, Hugo Barahona shared a very cool livebook tip. We'll have a link in the show notes. He's building a custom visualization for an Elixir data structure in livebook. He says all you have to do is implement the Kino.render protocol. And he shows an example visualizing a two-dimensional NX tensor as a matrix in the livebook UI using Markdown and LaTeX formatting. So you can kind of toggle between like the raw data and this really nice LaTeX visualization. So if your team is using Livebook internally when you work on your systems, I can imagine this being really cool to customize your like common or core data structures to be more friendly to look at.
You're saying LaTeX. I've always read it as LaTeX.
I've heard it both ways.
This was a rite of passage in college. Apparently people who are cool, people who know, say LaTeX. But yes, it's one of those like, it's a shibboleth that is like, why do we do this to each other? It's horrible.
I'm one of the goats then, not one of the sheep. And when it comes to this,
if you're wanting to look it up by spelling, it is LaTeX, like the material they make gloves out of, surgical gloves. And that's it for the news. Elixir and Phoenix are incredible. They make it possible to quickly build highly resilient and reliable systems capable of operating at incredible scale. Fly.io is a great place to host Elixir apps. You can deploy your app to multiple regions around the world with a private network linking them all together so your app can cluster and globally do some incredible Phoenix magic. Give your users a more responsive UI while writing less code and moving the app closer to your users without needing an ops team. Check out fly.io for your next Elixir app. While we're all hanging around for a little bit, I just wanted to ask you guys a little bit about what you guys are working on. So first, we just have to say hi to Tyler. Thanks for joining us this morning, guest hosting on the news. You know, Cade, he recently announced they had a new baby in the family, and he just needs to reprioritize some things and had to step back from the show. So thanks, Tyler, for stepping in and helping us do the news. That was awesome.
I'm delighted to. Yeah, it's both awesome to be on one of my favorite podcasts and terrible because when the episode comes out, I've already heard it. Can't have it both ways.
Well, I wanted to just talk with both of you guys and see what kind of stuff are you working on these days? You know, what's occupying your mental space and just kind of share what's going on in our lives around tech.
You don't want to hear about me planting fruit trees?
That could be cool, especially if you build that robot tree picker, you know.
Ooh.
Using nerves, that'd be awesome.
Love it.
With fruit AI recognition, yeah.
Does it have tracks? Is it just kind of like tank around and shake trees or something? That sounds fun.
Yeah, well, I'll go first. So just recently, I went to Google Next, which was the big conference, the big Google conference they had in Las Vegas. It wasn't very far for me, and some of our investors at Fly said, we can get you guys a couple tickets. Do you want to go? And they're like, yeah, I'll go. So I guess my summary was, that is the biggest conference I have ever been to, any kind of tech event that I've ever been to, over like 30,000 people. It was massive and quite overwhelming. And there's 3 days, and then there's many simultaneous tracks going on. And so that was interesting. But what I noticed is that by far more than half, without actually measuring it, but that was by the feel, it was all AI. AI this, that, or something else. AI features coming to Google, AI partners doing something with Google and Google Vertex AI or Gemini. And I was just really surprised at how much AI focus it was. So a lot of it was hype, right? You know, it's like, oh, we're hyping new Google products or enhancements and, oh, just released today for preview release for now for this conference, you know, that kind of stuff too. So it's like, how actually practical is this to use? I don't know yet. That was interesting. Google is betting the farm on AI is what it felt like.
AI's got a lot of attention right now for like politically, you know, like there's a lot of policy that needs to be written and is being written, you know, a lot of uncertainty. Lots of investors are paying attention to this kind of stuff. Yeah, a lot of attention.
Yeah.
I know it's going to have a good impact. I know it. Like I've already seen some good impact from AI stuff. But, you know, like I'm also bearish on what this really means for like day-to-day work. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I've interviewed some folks like for a programming job that like overly relied on AI. It's just slightly embarrassing to see them work, you know, like yeah. The particular ones that I witnessed, at least, it allowed them to skip engaging with it, with the, you know, themselves, and rely too much on offloading that to something that can't think that really, you know, critically. And it's just my general commentary, I guess, on AI. It's like, as much hype as it gets for like how that's going to take away people's jobs, and I'm sure that is happening, it still seems to need a whole lot of like management and verification and care and like programming to make this even work, you know, like that kind of stuff to make AI useful. I'm still bearish on like on it completely changing the way that life looks like, but it's definitely a new tool. Like if we didn't have shovels and then all of a sudden we had shovels, people were like, this shovel's amazing. It will change all my life, you know? And now that we have the shovel, it's going to be great. This new shovel, it's going to be super great, but we're still digging holes, you know, like we're not completely changing our lives, I don't think.
Yeah,
I'm going to go ahead and apologize for my terrible metaphor, but like
the next step of that metaphor would be that's when you add like a backhoe and then you're like automating a lot of it. It's like, hey, you just removed X number of shovel workers, right? With this faster skills required, but, you know, faster tool. One of the perspectives I got was ways that people are using it right now in business. And I thought, this is interesting. It's not the hype, right? So one of the ideas is, okay, they're using it for marketing. It's like, yeah, you know, does that mean we're losing all these marketers? So it's like, well, it does mean that junior marketers are not going to be creating marketing briefs for customers because that can be all automated with AI. Where they were going with it is the idea that it's not like we're getting rid of marketers, we now have the ability to market in a new way where using visual AI, you know, you can edit this image to change the people in it to be more appropriate for this racial group or this geographic demographic, you know, like we're wanting to target this nationality. And so we're going to be running this same ad campaign in a different region, right? And so you want to make it more regional. So you can do that kind of stuff where you're immediately just changing the people in the picture to fit where the target audience is, and that you can create much more specifically tailored marketing. So it's marketing that could be based off of your particular preferences. Like if it's email marketing or something, it's like, how are you using the product? We can see all of that and we can market something more specific. So it's like new types of marketing. Like if you're talking about like the number of pieces of individual marketing that are created, it would like go huge, right? Like now we're creating a massive amount of marketing material, but it's very specialized. It's like, I could totally see that. And that's not taking away jobs. Not necessarily, right? Like it's just enabling a new way of reaching people. So that was interesting. But I did want to mention that a lot of the sessions were talking about the tools that we use for accessing this. And so, you know, obviously they were pushing their services, Google services, but they're also talking about LangChain. And that's the Python and JavaScript or TypeScript versions of LangChain as, you know, being these big player in the open source area. Even Google people were contributing to the LangChain library to add support for their models and stuff like that. And really, that is why I created the Elixir LangChain library, because I feel it's really important, because I don't want to have my Elixir app have to pull in a Python or Node app just so I can hook into these other models and have these features. I can see how this is core to the way business can operate, and I want to make sure that my Elixir app has native access for it. So that's why I created that, and that's really my motivation for going to the conference too. It's like, I wanted to see what was going on with all this AI stuff.
Nice.
That's my update, I guess.
Did you see Elixir, you know, and anywhere other than yourself? Like, was anyone talking about it, showing it off?
Nope. No Elixir there. I didn't see any of it. But they talked about Java, you know, you can imagine.
Ooh,
that's a big one. Mm-hmm. Showing how Java can do some of these things. Yes. Like right now, I guess my update is I've been working on this major update to the library, the LangChain library. But the idea is just that being able to integrate an Elixir application with a LLM, a large language model, mm-hmm. that's what it is. Right now, I'm going through this major update because ChatGPT, OpenAI, they changed their structure to not be around functions, to be around tools, and it changes the API in more ways than just like a name change. And also added support for multimodal inputs, which means you can have, as a user message, you can say, here's text and an image, and then more text, another image, and be able to send that to a model that understands images and be able to have conversations about images. And so adding support for that. Right now I'm adding support for Anthropic's Claude 3 models because they just added support for functions or tools. And it's like, yes. Now it's actually really useful to me. So let's see if we can get that hooked in. So that's what I'm in the middle of. Like, it is not ready yet, but it's exciting work. I just feel like it's really important to have an answer for this in the Elixir space.
Yeah.
So Tyler, what are you up to?
Yeah, you know, I've been fighting with Mox, M-O-X, the mocking library that's kind of standard in Elixir. I discovered in our code base at work that we have probably 20 test modules where we had put like expectations, you know, expect that such and such mock will be called and, you know, return this fake value. And we weren't actually checking to see whether those expectations were verified. We were missing in the mocks documentation. You'll see they tell you to put like setup and then call their verify and exit function. And the problem with not having that setup function is unless you are manually verifying in every test that your mocks were called, there's just no error that you'll get if they don't get called. Yeah, I'm going through those tests and figuring out like which of these is it actually an error that it wasn't called and which of them do we just need to remove the expectation because it was like incorrect from the start. I gotta say it's been a pain. I'd really like to get to a point where I get, you know, CI failures if we try to use mocks and don't have that verification, something like that. I don't know. So maybe there's a credo check that I need to write, something that says like if you're using mocks, always have that set up, or I don't know. Have you all experienced this?
Yes and no. I've definitely forgotten to copy and paste a lot of setup code for tests. I don't know. I have a love-hate with the setup blocks. This kind of illustrates it. I mean, I don't know a great way around it. How long has it been? Just think about it for a second. Like, how long has it been since you've written RSpec? You know, like RSpec with describes and contexts and describes and tests, and it's like five layers of nesting in there, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the past that I was burned by, and PTSD maybe reaction to never doing that again. Yes, my test is three lines long, hallelujah, but I have no idea what's actually in this test now, you know? The setup block, even though it's like it's kind of necessary sometimes, the setup block in Elixir, it tastes too much like RSpec to me. I just don't now. And my preference has been to have setup in the function, in the test, I mean. Like, and if it's tedious, put it into a function, but in the test, not a setup block, because it's too far away at this point. There are exceptions to my insanity, like con, like the con for a controller test. Like, yeah, put that in a setup block. That feels normal to me for some reason. I'm not gonna build that up with a function call every single time. But like beyond that, though, especially for mocks, that feels like that should be like a function that you call in your test. You have to be very explicit for that. For what it's worth, I generally don't actually use mocks. Where I would use mocks is because I have an HTTP call that's going out to an external service or something. Rec just came out with like a guide on how to test your external stuff like that. They mentioned mocks in there for global stuff, which is nice. But I guess I've just always, I've wrapped my stuff up to throw an exception in test when it detects like an external call that hasn't been mocked. So that's been my saving grace, I guess. That was a long explanation of like, yes, I've seen it, but no, I don't experience it because I've avoided it.
I don't really use the mocks library, so I haven't experienced that personally. But I have this habit where I can't be done with a test until I've seen it fail. So like, I have to do something to make it fail. Then I fix it to be like, yes, this is actually what I want to test and have it pass. So like, that would probably have caught some of those types of things, but that's just like me being obnoxious and just like, I want to make sure that my test is actually working, because I've been burned by that before, you know, like where the test is not testing what you thought it was. Your code is broken, but all the tests pass. And I hate that.
Yeah. In this particular case, it's billing stuff.
Ooh.
There's a surprising surface area where like billing is implicated, you know, whether it's calling out to Stripe to be like, you know, we added a new user or whatever, mm-hmm. stuff like that. I'm not entirely sure that mocking was the correct strategy, but boy, we're committed now.
Yeah, but that's also one of those areas where you really want to make sure it's right. This is where we make money or don't.
Absolutely.
Or if you bill someone incorrectly, that'd be the worst.
Mm-mm-mm. Yeah, I don't know. I like the idea. I'm just too scared to dip my toes into those waters. Maybe it was also because of like the whole process dictionary kind of thing too, is process-based. And I was just also afraid of that. So like before I even adopted mocks, I would like explicitly pass in stubs and drill down to get that like to be passed down all the way. And then just didn't do integration tests on these.
That's nice.
That's got its own problems.
Well, David, what about you? What are you up to?
Home ownership is one thing. Potty training is another thing. This is relevant. I submitted my candidacy for the Erlang Ecosystem Board election.
Ooh. Nice. Is it just to be on the board or is it specific working groups?
It's just board elections. And so I presume that working groups that have folks rolling off will be sorted out too over time. But yeah, this is just board elections.
So is this where you make your public claim to say, yeah, like,
let me go find a tree stump. I can
vote for me and all your dreams will come true.
Get my Southern drawl on it. Yo, folks, we've been misrepresented all this. I'm just kidding. We've been represented very well. It's just the cadence, you know. We've got three cycles of folks that come on and come off, and this is one of those cycles. I think every year there's a cycle of around three or four people that, you know, have served their time and can choose to roll off or be reelected. Just according to the page, you know, I don't have any inner knowledge here of how things work, but according to the page, board members are fairly invisible to the public, and they do the invisible work. I mean, like administrative kind of work of making sure the foundation is legal, signing papers, maybe doing a little infrastructure for making sure the emails are still working, running meetings, taking notes during the meetings, that kind of stuff. So this is not a very publicly glorious, you know, position, but it is the Erlang ecosystem. A lot of Elixir here. It's like, I found my digital home in that like around 7 years ago. And so I've just been, I bet my career on it. So This is how I feel. It shouldn't have taken me 7 years to like serve the community in a different role, right? And so this feels past due for me to give back in a way. It doesn't need to be a board membership. If I don't get elected, that's fine too. But found a way to serve and saw that and like, you know what? Now's the time and this is my community. I want to serve my community. A lot of folks out there might live in a home that's part of an HOA. You know, like I have no, I'm not going to equate Erling ecosystems to HOAs, but like if you've ever been to an HOA meeting, you know that like you're going to get crazy conversations about things that don't matter. like we need to repave all our streets. Well, ma'am, that's going to be $150,000. You got $150,000? Like, no. Okay. Well, then let's not spend the next 30 minutes talking about it. You know, like there's lots of examples like that of just things you got to do to keep the foundation running and got to take your notes, got to put on these kinds of events. And me being part of this podcast, I think I'd be able to help leverage, you know, this platform that we have together alongside the foundation. I think I actually do bring value. I'm not just a face. All right. Well, that's enough about that. But yeah, I'm putting myself up there to be elected and we'll see what happens.
That's cool.
Love that.
As of this moment, there's not even enough candidates to get elected into it. So I might just be a shoo-in at this point.
No vote necessary, right?
Well, you still got to vote, but there's not a competition part of this where somebody doesn't get elected.
Right.
At least as of this moment, we'll see what happens.
As someone who's on an HOA board, I joined my HOA board because there was conflict and some really bad stuff going on in the neighborhood. And it's like, this has got to change.
Yeah.
And so it's just to help settle things down. And it is a thankless job.
Well, thankfully, as I suspect, the ERLF, maybe I'll have to be more proper in how I say it. The Erlang ecosystem, I don't know if ERLF is acceptable. The Erlang Ecosystem Foundation, I don't think has that kind of drama. So
no, thankfully not.
Well, we'll see.
Yeah, that is cool because we don't want to expect the same people to just stay in those positions because having extra demands on your time that can wear you down. So it's great to be able to rotate through members of the community and just people who care about the community, who want to see foundation, the languages, all the working groups that want to see success. Mm-hmm. That's who we want there. So thanks for throwing your hat in the ring.
Yeah, we'll see. I'm getting pumped for ElixirConf US too. I see everyone tweeting about it, the EU one, which is like happening like nowish, I think. I submitted a talk there too. I don't know if it'll get accepted or considered, but you know, like I'm starting to think about it. I'm gearing up for the conference season over here in the US and still thinking about the talk that I proposed. So I'll have to put together something regardless if it's being accepted or not, because I've got coworkers of mine and, you know, training sessions that I want to do back at home to say, these are all going to be good topics. So I don't know. Long time, this is too much, but a long time ago, one of the things that I considered as a career for myself was getting an education degree. I was going to be a math teacher. That lasted about one class before I realized that they got paid junk. And also realized it had been 3 years since my last math class that I AP classed out of, you know, so I was rusty. So that didn't quite work out. But the educational streak in me, I think, is still going strong. I do find a lot of like joy out of creating, like, you know, I haven't gone and created courses and been an online instructor or any of that kind of stuff. But I love like pairing with folks, creating, you know, guides and that kind of stuff. I've definitely had a lull in actually publishing anything thanks to other, you know, commitments. I'll echo Cade here that it takes a lot of work to raise some kids, some young kids. The scraps of time that I'm able to provide, I find a lot of joy in creating those kinds of guides and stuff like that. Like I'm really happy with Safecto migrations, for example, and I got some more plans for it. I got a couple of things that I want to do to it to point some more things out, guide folks into not bringing down production for silly reasons, things that they just didn't realize, like, this is how it works. I can go into a couple more examples, but maybe I'll save that for Safecto migrations. I just put down the time and actually write it down instead of just talking about it here.
If you don't know what he's talking about with Safecto migrations, I just dropped a link in the show notes. There is a blog post, a series, and a GitHub repo that has all the guides of how to handle Ecto migrations in all these different scenarios. So David did all this work putting a lot of that together and is taking a lot of that inspiration from the Rails safe Ecto migrations that originally kind of started some of that. But, you know, then there's Ecto specific things and we prefer Postgres. So there's things like that. So thank you, David, for doing all that work.
It has saved my bacon so many times.
And mine. I still miss things. I go through certain scenarios. I'm like, oh man, like that took a lot longer than I thought it would. And I got a deadlock and then I realize, oh, that's right. I can't use the modify, you know, I can't use the modify helper because it wants to like retype the whole column and Postgres will rewrite the table. And now I got a deadlock. You know, this is a heavy table. It's like, it's just little things like that. Like, that guide saves my bacon all the time. That's part of the reason why I wanted to organize it and apply it to Ecto, because I couldn't remember it all. I needed a reference.
Well, thanks for sharing what you guys are thinking about and working on. It's interesting stuff. That's one of the things I kind of miss about being remote, is just being able to sit down and just have some of those conversations, like the Geek Fest, you know, like what's going on with you in this geeky way. So it's great to hear that kind of stuff. But unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you for listening. We hope you'll join us next time on Thinking Elixir.